think we almost have a quorum, so we'll start the bills on the agenda. We're going to start with Senate File 1218, Senator Erickson Ropes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you very much for hearing my bill today. I'm joined today by Polly Brunelli, who's a director from the Department of Defense in Washington, D.C. This bill originated with the Department of Defense, and we're very pleased to have her here today. And Secretary Mark Ritchie should be joining us shortly. He's Minnesota Secretary of State, and we also have Beth Frazier here, who works in Secretary of State's office, and both Ms. Brunelli and Ms. Frazier will be dealing with some of the technical aspects of the bill. But I'm very happy to tell you just a little bit about this bill. It has to do with some changes to the election law, where we're going to be allowing military personnel and family members and U.S. citizens who are living and working abroad to be able to vote electronically. The bill also deals with some changes in military numbers and identification tools that they'll be able to use, and then some emergency powers that are being granted to the Secretary of State to make sure that our armed forces are able to get their ballots on time. So with that general introduction, I will turn it over to Beth Frazier to give a little recap, or Ms. Brunelli, would you like to do that?
Should I introduce myself and tell more about what I do?
Okay.
As the director of the Federal Voting Assistance Program,
Ms. Brunelli, if you could just identify yourself for the record, please.
Oh, Polly Brunelli, director, Federal Voting Assistance Program.
Okay, thank you.
I administer the federal responsibilities of the Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act, and that act protects the voting rights of those absentee voters, military, their family members, and U.S. citizens residing outside the United States. And we estimate there are more than 6 million potential voters around the world. So my mission is to inform and educate those voters about their right to vote, to foster voting participation, and to protect the integrity of the process at the federal, state, and local levels. And in administering the law, I consult with the state and ask them to remove barriers to voting for all of these voters.
And Ms. Brunelli, just like you asked, now you were introduced as being with the Department of Defense. Do you have responsibility for non-defense citizens as well, State Department or?
Yes, I do. They're covered under the law as well. And we ask the State Department, U.S. embassies and consulates to make sure that those voters are informed about their right to vote. So what we do in our department is we have cadres of voting assistance officers. We essentially train the trainers. The voting assistance officers are those individuals at the military installations, at the installation level, the base level, all the way down to the unit level, and at the U.S. embassies and consulates, they're in the consular affairs section. So we in our office conduct workshops, and we go in and we tell them about the absentee voting process and school them in the process, and then what they do is they reach out to the communities. The military and family members, the State Department reaches out to the U.S. citizens abroad as well, and the federal employees that are working in the embassies. And we have overseas citizens groups as well that serve as voting assistance officers for us. So they have our materials, absentee voting materials, and they would know, they'd be informed, if they're Minnesota voters, about the procedures in Minnesota for absentee voting. We have a guide that informs our voters about the rules for that.
So hypothetically, if you take, I don't know, Finland, where I assume we don't have any American troops stationed, but if I'm an American national living in Helsinki and want to know how to vote, I'd go through the embassy, who would go through yourself or through your office.
Correct.
But it's handled in, to again use my hypothetical of Finland, That would be handled through the embassy, though. That would be the conduit as opposed to if there's an American base.
Correct. The embassy is the point of contact there, and we work with them, and then there are U.S. citizens groups that work with the embassies to get the word out. They have a warden system at many of the U.S. embassies and consulates. Those are individuals that go out to the communities and provide voting information or information to U.S. citizens, anything that they may need to know.
I don't suppose, again, to continue my hypotheticals, you'd have a place like Somalia might be difficult where we don't have diplomatic relations, and which is a kind of an unformed government. So I don't think you'd find any American nationals living in Somalia these days. But hypothetically, if you did, what about that kind of a situation?
If we did, and they had access to computers and to the websites and email, they would be informed through that type of system.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Fraser.
Beth Fraser, the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Secretary of State's office. Just to clarify, one of the main points of the bill is that we would send ballots to voters electronically, perhaps a PDF. We would not allow them to vote over the internet. They would need to print out the ballot and mail it back to us because of concerns about electronic security. In terms of this committee's jurisdiction, the one cost associated with the bill is rulemaking powers given to the Secretary of State's office to clarify some of the provisions in the bill. And we will need to do an extensive rulemaking anyway, and so our office will absorb these costs. And so there's no cost to the general fund from this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I've seen a lot of bills that include rulemaking, and I've never seen one that came in under four digits before, so I'm quite impressed after the frugal nature of your rulemaking process.
Senator Erickson Ropes, then, so what do we have in the bill itself? This sets up the process within the Secretary of State's office.
Yes, I'll let Beth Fraser talk more in detail about the contents of the bill.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, when you're done with your question, I just wanted to move the bill for Senator Erickson Ropes.
Mr. Chair, is your question specifically about rulemaking or more generally?
More generally. It sets I'm glancing at the language. But this is done, what, through your office to the county auditors?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We would work in coordination with the county auditors to provide ballots to voters who request to get them electronically. This also would allow voters to use a write-in ballot if there wasn't time for them to receive a ballot with the actual names of the voters. It would allow the children of Minnesotans who have actually never lived here to vote, so the children of missionaries or embassy officials or military folks overseas, as well as the emergency rulemaking provision. It also would provide some security for the ballots that doesn't currently exist, requiring that the ID number, military state ID or passport number on the application matches the number that's on the ballot. Currently, there's no sort of match required. And so, an unscrupulous postal employee, for example, could actually take all of the ballots and fill them all out. And even if it was kind of clear that they weren't filled out by the same person, right now there would be no basis to reject a ballot. And so this would provide some security that the voters who are supposed to be voting on these ballots are voting on these ballots. Those are the highlights, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. And then just another question on Section 11 talks about emergency powers, indicates the Secretary of State may prescribe by emergency orders, special procedures, or requirements. Is there any place else in statute that gives other constitutional officers emergency powers? Secretary of State Ritchie? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Secretary Mark Ritchie, Secretary of State Mark Ritchie. Yes, there's actually one other line of authority for our office in the case of a court ruling that would come down that would require the use of emergency powers to make the adjustment signed by the court so that the ballot and the voting process could happen in a timely manner.
Okay, thanks. All right. Further questions? Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson Ropes, that same section, Section 11, I'm curious at the way this is constructed. It starts with, if the governor has declared an emergency and filed the declaration, then goes on to say, or if a natural disaster or armed conflict involving, and then some other events. Is it anticipated or that there might be another type of emergency besides the ones that are listed here? I'm curious about why it says or and why it doesn't say in response to a natural disaster, armed conflict.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, we was just noted in our last discussion there are times when the military will announce an extension without people ever had any kind of notice that this was going to happen, and that creates a change in their circumstance without any kind of anticipated planning.
Further questions from committee members? Okay, Senator Berlin.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1218 be recommended to pass.
Okay. We have Senator Berlin's motion. unfortunately, we're one short of a quorum.
Oh.
So if we can...
I'd be happy to cast two votes.
Three, five, six. Thanks.
We need for a quorum, Mr. Chairman.
We need one more. So I appreciate the offer, but...
Well, then I would just move the bill be laid over until we get a quorum and make the motion for
Yes, we'll...
Mr. Chair, does this committee allow absentee ballots?
Good question. That doesn't work here. So, Senator Action Ropes, once we get a... We'll start the next bill, probably Senator Scheid, and our Senator... Let's do Senator Scheid's bill first, and once we get the additional member, we'll vote on the bill. So, appreciate people being here, Ms. Brunelli. Thanks for coming, and hopefully, we'll have somebody here within a minute or so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Yeah, we do.
Okay. Well, let's hold on.
I renew my motion. Hey,
Senator Dill, just the person we're looking for. All right.
That Senate File 1218 be recommended to pass.
All right, we have Senator Berglund's motion that Senate File 1218 be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members.
And Senator Scheid. Senator Scheid, Senate File 1073. And there's a division report from, I believe, Senator Betzold. Is that correct?
Yes, I would move the division report, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have Senator Betzold's motion in front of us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you've seen me here with these bills before. This is ratification of the state employee contracts. Well, the underlying bill is that ratification of the state employee contracts that weren't settled by the end of last session. They were settled and negotiated and settled after we adjourned. So that there are two collective bargaining agreements, one compensation plan. The collective bargaining agreements are the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association, the Minnesota Nurses Association, and then we have the compensation plan for the unrepresented employees at HESO, the Office of Higher Education. So the bill was amended, I think, in GovOp. Mr. Hubinger reminds me to add the gambling control. The salary of the director of the Gambling Control Board. Each of these things has gone through the LCC's Subcommittee on Employee Relations. We met just a couple of weeks ago, and actually we then in that meeting looked at proposals increasing the directors of the three retirement plans. This is the helicopter flyover, I think.
You're in line in that information.
The PERA, the MSRS, and the TRA directors, and the subcommittee did approve those increases. And it, what it did was take them to the cap, I think, of 102,000. For some reason, I'm not looking at my in the right place, but that's what it did. So we need an amendment here. And then, Mr. Chairman, I think that you're wanting the bill. The bill will go on its own. This is out of the current budget. Am I correct?
Well, I was going to say that, and I just asked Mr. Mosman, but apparently these were all negotiations that were ratified, that were done in the fall of 2006. So I assume then reflected in the governor's budget proposal of this winter.
Mr. Chairman, that's right. Right.
Senator Betzel?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the division report doesn't reflect any amendments, but there was an A2 amendment. I believe this is the one that was adopted in the budget division, so we may still have to adopt the A2 amendment because I don't know that it's reflected in the bill that we have before us.
Mr.
Chairman. Senator Scheid?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The A2 amendment needs to be adopted, but the A1, which was the Gambling Control Board, I believe,
That was the one.
That was done earlier.
But, Mr. Chair, the division report doesn't reflect any amendments, so I'm not quite sure. But it shows that the first engrossment, so it's in there. So,
Mr. Chairman, they were done in the policy committee before it came to your division.
Gotcha.
Okay. So, do we have the what?
So I'll move the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the A2 amendment is in the packets.
Yes, it is.
Move the A2 amendment.
We have Senator Berglund's motion in front of us. Further discussion on the A2 amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Scheid.
And, Mr. Chairman, then I would appreciate a motion to move
the
bill as amended.
Okay. Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 1073 as amended be recommended to pass. Further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Chairman,
thank you, Senator Scheid.
Thank you for taking care of that.
Senator Sharon. Okay. Senator Sharon, I understand we have the House file. Yeah, the House file has come over. House File 472 is what we'll be working off of.
Not Senate File 239?
No, it looks like the House file has come over, so we would work off the House file.
Has that been amended?
They are identical.
I'm told it's the same bill.
Okay. Thank you. Should I be seeing that then?
So, Senator Sharon, House File 472.
Thank you very much. Chairman Cohen and members of the committee, this House file is a bill that asks us to assist David Arnold with a turbine that he built. And I have a handout. I don't know if anybody has that to be distributed. And in this handout, if you read through this, you'll see the history of the events that occurred that resulted in the problem that we're trying to correct in this piece of legislation. As you see, in terms of the timetable, Mr. Arnold met all the necessary criteria necessary for him to be able to be included under the renewable energy production incentive eligibility. And this bill, if you look at the language, simply extends the period of time that the applicant can file to allow for this singular situation that has occurred. There are no other filers. There are no other applications that have come to the Department of Commerce in relationship to this. So because of this kind of series of unintended problems and difficulties, Mr. Arnold asks for relief by an extension of this date. He has worked with the Department of Commerce. They had worked with them all the way through this period, and because the application process got lost in the mail, returned to him, and then sent back in an untimely way, he fell out of the eligible time period in which he could be approved. That's essentially what this is about. Jeremy DeFebri is here with me from the Department of Commerce. If you have questions specifically about the program or about whether or not any questions at all about this process.
I see.
Mr. Chair,
Sarah Anderson.
Would you like me to move the division report? Did we do that yet? You don't need to because it's a House file.
It's the House file.
Okay.
Mr. DeFebri, is there anything you'd like to offer the committee or?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Jeremy DeFebri with the Department of Commerce, and I just want to state that we do support this this bill and the effort to remedy what we think was an unintentional consequence of actions that were taken in 2005. I'll answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I just want to point out that in the division we supported the bill and that it won't have any impact on state funds, but only on the Renewable Development Fund, and it's a one turbine wind, very small farm. So I would move that Senate File 239, House File 472. I'm catching on. I'm practicing for my bill, which is the same. be recommended to pass.
Okay, we have Senator Anderson's motion in front of us. Is there further discussion?
Senator
Pappas.
I noticed that in the other body they put it on the consent calendar. Did you want to amend your motion to do that?
Mr. Chair, I would amend my motion to include that.
All right. Senator Anderson moves that House File 472 be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much.
Senator Anderson, do you want to present the LCCMR? So we have...
We already do the.
The House file.
Yes. Erickson Ropes? Yes. Okay.
All right. Senator Anderson, apparently we're working off of House File 293.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I guess I don't have to make any motions to get that in front of us, correct?
That's correct.
All right. The House did pass this bill shortly after the Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division recommended it.
Mr. Chair, could I just ask a procedural question? Even though we have the House file before us, would that have included the amendments that were made in the budget division then?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just you're one step ahead of me there. Okay. That's exactly, it puts it in exactly the same form that it left the division in. So we included the same amendment. So that's what we have in front of us is without having to adopt that. Mr. Chair, you were correct to add the extra C. The LCMR is now the LCCMR, and that incorporates the addition of citizen members who are voting members of the commission now as a result of changes made last year. just as a reminder, there's 17 members, 5 representatives, 5 senators, 7 non-legislative citizen members, and we receive 40% of the net proceeds from the lottery funds. The major themes that we funded this year include land protection and water quality. The land protection proposals were based on previously funded projects, and we did issue an RFP for water quality projects. We received 85 proposals totaling over $62 million. And in the end, as you will see in the bill, the total appropriation that we have available, which we're recommending expenditures of, is $23,366,000. And this is one of the changes that we made in the LCCMR reform process, is to have this be a yearly expenditure and a yearly process and a yearly recommendation rather than a 2-year process. So what I'd like to do is go through very briefly, describe each of the projects that we funded, if the committee wants to hear that much detail. We do have Senator Parisot and Senator Frederickson, who are members of the commission as well, who are here today.
And then, Senator Anderson, just in terms of the membership, there's one Senate appointee, not senators, but citizen appointee?
It's
two appointees of the governor and one from the House, one from the Senate. Is that correct?
Yes. Three. 5 from the governor, one from the House, one from the Senate.
Senator Frederickson?
Senator Anderson.
Sorry, I didn't mean to say yes. It's 5 members, 5 citizens appointed by the governor, 1 by the House, 1 by the Senate. I believe John Herman was the Senate appointee. All right, so let's just, if you look at the bill, And I guess the copy, we do have, do we have the House file in front of us?
Okay.
Yes. Well, except I highlighted the Senate file, so that's the one I'm going to use. so when I had this morning. The first expenditure is for administration purposes, and that is an $1,318,000. And then we go on to the project appropriations. And the first category is for land acquisition and improvement. The first one is the Forest Legacy Conservation Easements Program, $2 million to acquire permanent working forest conservation easements on private forests in northern Minnesota, the Mississippi Blufflands, and other areas. Any of these easements acquired have to have a sustainable management plan in place. And I do have an amendment to offer, which I'll do after I go through the bill that affects that program. Second is the Minnesota Habitat Corridors Partnership Phase 4. This is $4.2 million recommended for this program, which works with a large variety of nonprofit partners throughout the state to plan, restore, and acquire fragmented landscape corridors that connect areas of quality habitat to sustain fish, wildlife, and plants. And this, all of these land acquisition programs are ones that have been previously supported by the LCMR over a number of years, some of them. The Metro Conservation Corridors is recommended for $2.5 million, and this is similar to the Habitat Corridors Partnership, but it's focused on the metropolitan area for the purposes of planning, restoring, and protecting important natural areas in the metropolitan area. So to acquire land and protect it from development and for habitat and other purposes of protecting land of real natural value. Moving on to next is the Prairie Stewardship Assistance for Private Landowners, and we're recommending $220,000. To develop stewardship plans and prairie management on privately owned lands that have prairie on them on a cost share basis with private or federal funds. The next program is the State Park and Trail Land Acquisition. We're recommending $1.5 million to acquire land for state trails and inholdings for state parks. And then for the Metropolitan Regional Park System, we recommend $2.5 million for land acquisition for grants for the acquisition of lands within the park unit boundaries of the Metropolitan Park System. We also recommend $1 million for non-metropolitan regional parks as well as natural and scenic area acquisitions to provide matching grants to local governments for acquisition of natural and scenic areas as well as regional parks that are outside of the metropolitan area. Next are the LAWCON federal reimbursements, and that's $500,000. And this is from the State Land and Water Conservation Account, which is reimbursed by the federal government for recreation lands. The next program is called Biological Control of European Buckthorn and Garlic Mustard. And this is where we start to get into some of the innovative types of programs that we fund in the LCCMR. And this is to research potential insects to be used for biological control of invasive plant species, buckthorn, and garlic mustard.
Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Pappas.
And then who's going to control the potential insects?
Well, that's a good question, Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas. Go ahead. We'll let Mr. Valeen, tackle that.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is John Valeen. I'm the staff director for the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. That's an excellent question. Thank you. It's one of the part of a very high standard that the LCCMR maintains. The commission has insisted over the years that only native species be used in the various restoration projects and so forth because, of course, native species have their natural enemies here and they're kept in balance by their natural enemies, the natural symbiosis. Imported species of any sort have virtually no enemies here. And so what needs to be done, part of this research actually supports an extensive quarantine process where the particular pests that are being considered are subjected to feeding and living conditions as they would be here in the state. And if they don't terminate, then they are no longer used. In other words, the quarantine process has to demonstrate that the pest will only survive on the intended target plant. Mm-hmm. And if it survives on any other targets, then it's no longer under consideration. It's taken out of quarantine, and none of it's ever released. Mm-hmm. And only after that extensive quarantine process do they even continue to further evaluate that particular pest. It may turn out that the pest is not particularly good at control of the target species, but nevertheless, it's certainly not allowed to go any further if it's going to damage something else.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I think there have been some examples in the past of research and use of biological controls that haven't been as well controlled, and you probably heard about those, but we have good controls in place now.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, the only thing that came to mind is in Israel they had a rat problem, and so the British imported cats, and now they really have a cat problem.
a lot
of wild cats.
Exactly.
Because there's no natural predator for cats. I don't even know if there is at all.
Bigger cats.
Dogs. Bigger cats.
Cars, yeah.
Bigger cats.
Human beings.
Humans, cars, yeah, et cetera. No, yeah. You're right. That's a good point, which we're trying to avoid.
All right, thank you.
The next project is called Neutralization of Reed Canary Grass Root Exudates, and this relates to the plant-soil feedback from the things that are released from the roots of these plants that some scientists believe may be able to help reduce the invasiveness of reed canary grass. And then on to water resources, the local water management matching challenge grants, and we recommend $350,000 to Bowser, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, to accelerate the local water management challenge grant program. And this is a long-term program as well that helps local groups address water quality issues. Next project is for protection of rare and unique rock outcrop wetlands. We're recommending $563,000 for easements, perpetual easements, to protect these areas of rock outcrops that many of us were not aware of in the southwestern part of the state. I suppose this is probably in Senator Fredrickson's district, correct? So he was probably aware of them. But there's some very unique rocks that are surrounded by a unique area of wetland habitat that needs to be protected. It's quite unique in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, I made another comment. The reason they're threatened to be destroyed is they make very attractive sites for contractors to mine the surface of them and make big rocks into very small rocks for various construction projects.
So is there a predator for the contractors?
Japanese lady beetles probably do it. Drive them crazy. Happy to,
we'll have to. Biological, natural.
Send about a million of them from my basement.
Donate some.
And I'll be outside of the house.
I don't know.
Yeah, we're going in dangerous waters there.
Senator Anderson.
Okay, next we'll move on to land retirement effects on the Minnesota River Basin streams. And this is a recommendation of $275,000 to look at, we spent a lot of dollars over many, many years in the CREP program and others and CRP to set aside land. I'm not sure which is on the Minnesota River, CREP or CRP?
CREP is
Thank
Minnesota
you.
River.
And to set aside land and create buffers along the river to try to protect water quality. And this is an effort to try to evaluate the success of that in protecting water quality. Next, we have a $374,000 recommendation, which would go to the Science Museum of Minnesota for another innovative project to test the levels of lake sediments and where there's been conservation grasslands programs put in place to try to protect water quality and to test to see how successful the program is in reducing sediment and nutrient loads. The next project is improve river quality monitoring using airborne remote sensing, and this is $159,000 to Mankato State University to use this high-tech airplane sensing program called Airborne Dynamic Hyperspectral Remote Sensing, which will take a very detailed close picture and mapping of the Blue Earth River watershed to be able to monitor water quality there. The next project is evaluating riparian timber harvesting guidelines, $400,000 to a University of Minnesota research team that will work on this to look at making sure that we have good standards in place along waterways in forested areas to protect terrestrial, aquatic, and wildlife habitats in conjunction with working forest lands. Next is innovative spring shed mapping for trout stream management, $270,000 going to the University of Minnesota researcher to trace where water flows into cold water trout streams to see where pollution sources are coming from and see what impacts of development are on those cold water trout streams. The next program is called the Intra-Lake Zoning to protect sensitive lakeshore areas, $110,000. This would be used in Cass County to identify some of the highest priority sensitive shoreland areas where there's an effort to use some innovative shoreland zoning ideas that have been, to see how successful they can be at protecting the shoreland. Water resource sustainability is a recommendation of $292,000 to the University of Minnesota to quantify sustainable supplies of surface and groundwater. Next is the County Geologic Atlas Program, $400,000 to the University of Minnesota to continue the geologic survey of or the production of county geologic atlases to keep to create a better inventory of information across Minnesota that will help us protect groundwater. The next program is $300,000 recommendation for the University of Minnesota, where the research is going on by a Duluth professor on climate change and impacts of climate change on Minnesota's resources, in particular aquatic resources, to quantify climate, hydrologic, and ecological trends and impacts of future climate change on aquatic systems in our state. The next program is $302,000 to a University of Minnesota researcher to develop technologies to help to eliminate antibiotic-resistant bacteria, hormones, and other pharmaceutical compounds that are now being found in Minnesota waters. Next is $97,000 to a St. Cloud State University researcher who's doing cutting-edge research on whether emerging contaminants, endocrine disruptors in waters that are affecting the feminization of fish, whether that's having long-term reproductive impacts on walleye. The next program is a $659,000 grant to the University of Minnesota Cedar Creek Natural History Area, and this will help to continue the world-renowned work of Dr. David Tillman, who's been studying the use of prairie plants for producing biofuels and also to sequester carbon dioxide and to grow these plants with minimal water and inputs. So this will help to continue and move that research forward. The next project is the pyrolysis pilot project, $500,000, and this is for a gasifier that will be taken around to various farm fields around the state that will be growing biofuels from, I believe, perennial plants to convert those from biomass feedstock into biofuels. So it's taking it directly from the laboratory out into the field to see how successfully that can be done. The next projects, there's three projects that fit under natural resource information, and the LCCMR has wanted very much to try to continue and complete some of the important work that's being done around the state to inventory our natural resources so we can do more effective work at protection. And these include the Minnesota County Biological Survey, the Soil Survey, as well as the Field Guide for Evaluating Vegetation of Restored Wetlands. And these three projects are for a total of $2,002,000. Next is natural resource data collection and mapping. That's also part of the data collection, the fourth one. We've also set aside $160,000 in an emerging issues account, which has not been recommended for any particular purpose yet. Most of the rest of the language is boilerplate language that we've had in place. Now, there's the leveraging language. Is that new?
Yes.
That's new. So the Subdivision 9 relates to language that ensures the leveraging of public dollars with non-state with non-state dollars. So there's some language there that that ensures that we maximize those matches. And then I think the rest of this language is existing language until we get to the public meeting. Is that correct? And then the very last section, 3, I'll just mention is policy language that relates to public meeting requirements. And this just incorporates changes that we need to make to ensure that there's accountability and public meeting requirements that fit with the participation of citizens along with legislators on the LCCMR.
Subdivision 16 is not re-
occurring. It's just extending a few of these projects.
Okay, and then Subdivision 16, I missed that, and that includes some carry forward for some ongoing projects that we've approved to continue their work and extend the timelines for those projects. And that really wraps up the bill. I mentioned that I have an amendment, which I'd like to offer, the A1 amendment.
Okay, if we could have that distributed.
In the division, and as well as in the House, we passed an amendment, which is what you saw in the division report, which is incorporated in this language, that attempted to make sure that in the forest legacy conservation easement programs, that owners of that land are not able to get funding from two different programs at the same time, because there's a lot of forest land that is currently enrolled in the FSIA, the Sustainable Forests Investment Account,
Incentive Act,
which with the forest legacy easement dollars being appropriated, there's a lot of forest owners that will want to take advantage of that program and put their land into permanent easements. And so what we've done is, in the language that's already in the bill, we've said that you can't be enrolled in both of those programs at the same time. However, since we made that change, it's come to our attention that there's lands that are already in one program in the Sustainable Forest Investment Account. Is that what
incentive.
You, incentive account, which it would be beneficial to allow them to enroll in the easement program because it's longer term and it has more protection. But we just want to make sure that they're not double-dipping, so to speak. And so at least for these new dollars, the A1 amendment would say that you're not, if you enroll in the easement program under the Forest Legacy Program that we're funding in this bill, then those lands will no longer be able to collect from the incentive program. So you can't be collecting from both of those programs at the same time. And so that's what the A1 amendment would do.
Senator Anderson moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Is there discussion on that?
Mr. Chairman, I just have one question because I don't think I've heard about this amendment before today because it is new. Mm-hmm. Is there some – does that create an incentive or a disincentive?
Well, and I should have mentioned that Senator Saxon asked me to do this amendment because there's concern that without it, then the northern forest lands that are in this sustainable forest program will not be able to participate in the forest legacy program. And so we do – it does – I guess it says you have to choose one or the other. If you want to stay in the one program, you can do that. But if you want to move to the easement program, you can do that. You just have to choose. You can't. And there's in previous years, there are landowners that are collecting both. And that's an issue we'll have to deal with it at a future date. But we're not attempting to deal with that in this bill. We're just dealing with the new dollars that we're appropriating.
New enrollees, okay.
Okay, we have Senator Anderson's motion in front of us. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, if there's no other questions, I would move that Senate File 450 be recommended to pass.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, if
House,
I may.
I am so sorry. I didn't quite get it. House File. I move that. Can I restate that?
Yes.
That I move that House File 293 be recommended
as amended.
Mr. Chairman, if I could delay for just a minute or two to make a couple comments. The first comment I'd like to make is at the end of the bill, the public meetings. The LCCMR, I think, is a very unique and unusual organization since it includes both legislators and citizens sitting at a table voting as equals and making recommendations. And particularly the citizens were very concerned about what constitutes a public meeting, and they didn't want to infringe and violate the public meeting rule. There was a lot of concern about emailing people back and members back and forth as we talked about various things. So the result is the Section 3 at the end of the bill to try to clearly delineify when a public meeting occurs. And, of course, we want all of our meetings to be public. But on the other hand, what we're struggling with, we didn't want to impede communication among members either. And this is the result of that.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, you're absolutely right. And it's been interesting to observe the citizen members come in and try to adapt to the rules of government, which are quite different from how they operate in the private sector with a lot more freedom. But it's for a very good reason, for accountability and public transparency.
And, Mr. Chairman, from my perspective, I was a little skeptical about this new organization, but I would say the citizens brought good perspective. They worked very hard. They brought a lot of good expertise to the table. And at least for this first go-around, I would say it has worked well.
Are there any members?
Senator Ferguson.
I have one other comment to make, but if you wanted to. The other point I'd like to point out is Senator Anderson described several research projects that are in here. And I'd like to bring to the committee's attention that those are not just research projects that we legislators and citizens thought would be good ideas and just read and said, well, this would be a nice thing to do. After we recommended them, they were reviewed by a peer review committee. To make sure that they really are legitimate research projects and we would get scientifically legitimate results from those projects. And I don't know if Senator Anderson or Mr. Valline would just very in a generic way say who the members of that peer review group is. Okay.
Mr. Valline.
Mr. Chair and members, because the commission recommends a different set of projects every year, we create a different peer review panel. And what we do is we look for expertise either in state or outside the state of Minnesota that would match up with the particular scientific disciplines that are involved in research projects, but also seeking people who may not be expert in that particular area but who are renowned scientists who can comment generically on the quality of the science. The purpose is to make sure that we get good scientists helping our research projects to improve the science in those projects. Some examples of, in past years, we've had people from Oregon, Canada, Ohio, Iowa. Where is Cornell University?
New York.
And in this past year, we had kind of a tight crunch in time. As a matter of fact, we just finished the peer review process a week ago. It takes a while to get the people together, to get the researchers to write up their research addendum in scientific terms and so forth. We had a person who is the Minnesota director of the Environmental Protection Agency served as our chair this time, an excellent researcher in his own right and obviously highly regarded, Carl Richards. A number of other people from disciplines of biology and soils at the University of Minnesota and at St. Olaf and at Minnesota State University and Winona State University. So we selected people who had some expertise in the particular areas represented by these research projects, and then some people who had expertise, even a person from a private consulting firm who has expertise in water hydrology, trying to cover the spectrum of expertise and perspective so that you get the best research you can.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, the only other comment I want to make, separate issue, is that part of the reform recommendations has been, besides speeding up the process, has been that the LCCMR bill travels separately and quickly from the omnibus bill. And we've made an attempt to do that. It's already passed the House, and I know your committee's been backed up for a couple weeks reviewing all the omnibus bills. And so we appreciate your giving us the time to get this passed. We're hoping to pass it soon on the floor and send it to the governor so that it can be done. And members will remember in past years it's been combined with the Omnibus Environment Finance Bill, and so that's one thing that is unique.
Mr. Valline, let me ask a question about the peer review process. So do you set up administratively the panel on a yearly basis then to look at what might come in front of the commissioner on a biannual basis?
Mr. Chair, the typical approach has been to await the commission's decisions on which projects to recommend. Typically, we would get 30, 40 different research projects. And to do all this peer review process on 30 or 40 projects when only a few are going to actually wind up being recommended seems a little bit exorbitant, largely because the We do ask the scientists to write up a research addendum. Often those are 30 to 40 pages long, a very detailed explanation of methodology, procedure, citations from other known research and so forth. So we typically don't form the peer review panel until we see what the commission has recommended. And then we go through the particular project, select the expertise, and run the peer review process that way. Did I get to your question?
Yeah, part of it. So when were the final recommendations made by the commission?
In December?
January 5th.
Of 06 or January, we wrapped it up. Mm-hmm.
So the panel was in operation for what, January, February?
Mr. Chair, we began forming the panel as soon as we knew that the commission recommendations were done. It took us some time to find appropriate people and find some time. We actually conducted, the peer review panel itself met in March. We first had to request the program managers to devise this detailed research addendum and then go find the peer review people and then have them look at all the peer review projects to be peer reviewed. So we allow them a fair amount of time, A, to produce the addendum, and B, for the peer reviewers to actually review it scientifically. So over that period of 3 months, a lot of work went on, both by the project managers and by the peer reviewers, pretty much in their own realm. We were using electronic communication very heavily, which has helped us a lot.
So hypothetically, if the panel were to say this particular proposal recommended by the commission is just without any scientific merit, would you go back to the commission and say, let's not do this?
Mr. Chair, absolutely yes. Again, because this year was pretty rushed, we weren't able to do the peer review process before the bill actually was introduced and went on through the legislature. Ordinarily, we try to set up the time schedule so that we would finish recommendations late summer, early fall, which gives us a space of time to do the peer review so that before the commission finalizes its recommendations, we can actually have that advice available. There are generically three different answers. One is, yes, it's good science, go for it. B, it's pretty good science, there are some things that should be fixed in order to make it better science, for replications, for example, or more explanation of methodology. The third one is, it's junk, and it shouldn't be considered at all as a scientific project. And we will report, this year we will report back to the commission as soon as we can get the commission together. Obviously, 10 of our members are pretty heavily engaged in the legislative process with the results of the peer review. Those are not quite finalized yet. And so this year it'll be a matter of whether or not the commission approves the work program on one of those three alternatives. Ordinarily, the commission would speak to that before we finalize the recommendations, but it just didn't work out this year.
So given the change in the nature of the commission, this year was an awkward year in terms of the calendar, but your expectation at this point is that the peer process will be implemented from now on in the context of a timeline with what the legislation is.
Mr. Chair, before the commission, I'm hoping before the commission signs off on a bill.
Okay. And let me ask a couple of other questions. This one, Senator Betzold, if you'll allow me. It's been years since I've served on the Data Privacy Subcommittee. You're a much more recent member. You've had a chance to review the public meeting section of the bill?
Mr. Chair, the public meeting laws are in the purview of the State and Local Government Operations Committee, not data practices. So, but
and was it reviewed at all, Senator Anderson, by?
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to remember what that discussion. I know we never went there, and we were never requested to go there. And I'm trying to remember if we had any discussion about that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, are you talking about in committee or in the commission? Because I recall that the very first meeting of the combined new reformed LCCMR, The statutes that applied to public meetings were run through, so everybody had an understanding.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Chair, you're correct. We spent a lot of time talking about this.
That was a long discussion.
And we had some expert advice from some of our knowledgeable staff, legislative council, about it.
So who was involved then in terms of legislative staff?
Who was it again? Who McCormick. Did the,
This was Mark Shepard.
Oh, Mark Shepard and
McCormick.
And McCormick. That's right. Mr. McCormick, yeah. And so we had a presentation to the commission, the new joint commission, to talk about what the current law says for open meetings under the old LCMR, how it affects legislators, and then extensive discussion about it as we prepared this language.
So who would counsel from here be? Mr. Bodern?
Probably Bodern.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have any senators.
Did he have that jurisdiction, that assignment this past year, or is that just at the start of this session?
I don't remember when he took it over, because I'm new to that committee, Mr. Chair.
It was before this year.
Senator Rask. Okay.
Okay.
So was
right, Mr. Chair, just so I also confirmed, which I had forgotten, that Senator Rest declined to bring the bill into her committee, just so people know.
Okay.
That's what I'm told by staff. We have plenty of time to do that.
Okay, let me ask a couple of other questions about the nature of some of the proposals. Either Senator Anderson or Mr. Villene, the appropriations to the general appropriations, I think in Minnesota Habitat Corridors and the Metro Conservation Corridors to Minnesota Land Trust, Ducks Unlimited, Friends of the Mississippi. I'm trying to recall, has this been commonly done in the past?
Yes.
I think you've had other appropriations to some of these organizations.
Both of the Habitat Corridors programs have been funded several years in a row by the LCMR.
So how does that work in terms of how much in particular given to, say, the Nature Conservancy or Ducks Unlimited?
Maybe you should talk about that, how it's divided up.
Mr. Chair and members, 4B, Minnesota Habitat Corridors Partnership, addresses outstate areas of non-metropolitan areas of the state. This group of entities mentioned in here have formed a partnership, and they actually present a proposal to the commission that proposes certain amounts be allocated to certain organizations for specific purposes, whether it's acquisition, restoration, it might be easement acquisition or fee or land restoration, including some of the administrative costs that go along with acquiring land or restoring land. So their proposal actually lays out, at least on a line item basis, if not some cases more specifically, what the different organizations will receive. Typically, the commission has said the number that, as a matter of fact, that $4.2 million number this year, their proposal level was $5,997,000, as I recall. And the commission said that's a little more than we want to bite off, so come back to us with a revised proposal. And by the way, say a few other things about X or Y or Z. So there's an opportunity there to request a revision and also reconsider the dollar amounts. And the commission members in that particular case this year did go in and knock out a couple of specific line item projects that members with which members felt uncomfortable. One of them had to do with stocking fish in wetlands, and commission members had just learned that fish in wetlands wind up competing for the ducks wind up having to compete with the fish. Turns out that flesh-eating fish are pretty good for that, and non-flesh-eating fish, bottom feeders, are not so good for it for wetlands. The bottom feeders stir it up and make it cloudy. On the Metropolitan Corridors Project 4C, it's similar but slightly different. That project comes in with two pieces. One is an allocation to the various members, who are all named in here, to do these certain things, which is similar to 4B. But they also have a dollar amount, and I've forgotten the specific dollar amount in this particular $2.5 million, a dollar amount that will be available to run grants for acquisition or for restoration projects, and they're supposed to run some sort of a public process for that, for that delivery of those grants. Now, I have asserted to the Metropolitan Conservation Corridors Project that in running those grants, the unallocated amount, that there ought to be a very high standard set for deferring away from any possible conflict of interest. I went so far as to say that I don't think that people who are on the advisory committees who are making the rating and recommendations on the grants, they should not be applicants at the same time. This has caused a bit of consternation, but it occurs to me that if you are both an applicant for the grant and a reviewer for the grant, you have an inside track that's a little bit unfair. And so while that's I'm sure news to you and Representative Tingelstad, our current House chair, but we just had that discussion at 5:15 last night. So that's one minor difference between those two. But I think the department will take a close look at the Legislative Audit Commission reports on grant management and procedures, and realize that it's best practice to keep the people not conflicted so that you get a more reliable result.
Okay, well, this raises other questions in my mind then. So following up, I just several questions about this, but following up in terms of being an applicant, Friends of the Mississippi River, if I contribute $50 a year to that organization, am I then an applicant? So that if I'm a staff person at the DNR, I'd be prohibited from making that kind of a recommendation. What's the definition of an applicant or an applicant member? Is it a contributor? Is it a board member? Is it a staff person?
Mr. Chair, we've defined that not quite so broadly as if you're just a member or even if you are a board member. If you're a staff member, if you're one of the proponents, one of the people who has signed on to the application, you should not also be involved as the advisory committee that's recommending how those grants should occur. We apply that same standard to commission members. We have now with the citizen members, we have people who are members of advocacy organizations all around the state, and in some cases there will be their particular organization will be applying to the commission. What we've advised them to do is to recuse, that is, not be involved in the discussion, not be involved in advocacy one way or the other, and certainly not to be involved in the decision making.
Okay, then following up again, we'll use the conservation corridors. You have enumerated in the legislation several groups, but if this is basically a grant program, why would we specify the several groups as opposed to some other group you're not aware of?
Mr. Chair, the distinction should be made between 4B and 4C. In 4B, all of those people were part of that. They were applicants. They were part of the overall application process and with a proposed allocation to do acquisition or easements or restoration. So they were named in the application, and they are thus also named in the legislation.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
That's to make sure that there's authorization.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, every member of LCCMR were active in the rating of all the proposals. And I think that many of them looked at the potential for partnership, regardless of the applicant, you know, whether that applicant was a loner or whether they had potential for attracting a lot of partners, and that changed the rating values, I believe, in many people's minds. It certainly did when I rated mine, because I thought if you can attract partners from other sources, that puts you at a higher level to me.
Okay. So I'm just trying to understand the appropriation process within the appropriation process. So let me get back. Let me ask directly about the conservation corridors. You indicated that's a grant program primarily. Do I understand that correctly?
Mr. Chair, there are two conservation corridors projects, 4B and 4C.
Okay, so let's talk about 4C.
And 4B is not a grant program. 4C
is a grant program. Yeah, right, that's what I understood your testimony.
Part of it is, excuse me.
Okay, so if it's a grant program, as to the grant program, can you only grant to these groups?
Oh, Mr. Chair, no. No, that's not.
Okay.
Again, part of it is an allocation for them to do specific work. Part of it is an allocation for them to run a granting program.
All right.
And so the granting program is not restricted to just these groups. In fact, in my comments about my advice to them to for best practices for grant management, that's where I suggested that the very people who are members of this group ought not to be both applicants and advisors on giving grants to somebody, in that case themselves.
Okay. Then let me get back to 4B, the Habitat Corridors, which is not a grant program, where monies are allocated to these organizations. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So how would I know how much is going to Nature Conservancy?
Mr. Chair, I have that right here. There's a table in the back of this one.
And Mr. Chair, I don't necessarily know programs for each entity that receives money has a work program where it's specified, yeah, and they work with staff on the dollar amount and what the requirements are. So that's
I don't necessarily need to know
documentation the LCMR.
Okay. And I don't necessarily need to know the amount. I'm just
we have that internally with the LCCMR.
Okay, I guess my general question is, it seems to be unusual where, for instance, if the appropriation was $4.2 million from the trust fund to the DNR commissioner for this purpose, and you wouldn't specify the partners, but if you are going to specify the partners, why wouldn't you include a line item for each of the partners if that's known, just in terms of laying out the budget?
Mr. Chairman,
could I
just take longer?
Mr. Chair, we actually have practical experience with exactly that. Mm-hmm. In the outstate Habitat Corridors project shown here as 4B, in the first biennium, we split the dollar amount so much for land acquisition by fee title, so much for easement acquisition, and so much for restoration, and so much for administration, coordination, and mapping. And we put those numbers into the appropriation rider language. Within 6 months, we found that there were more restoration projects or more acquisition projects, I've forgotten which way it went, available and they were interested in doing than those particular dollar amounts restricted them to. And so in 2003, 2005, and again in 2007, we've taken out that internal allocation number in order to allow. It's a question of opportunity. In some cases, there might be a large acquisition that's available that would exceed the amount that we happen to guess at in writing up the appropriation allocation. It is possible to do it that way, and if that's more comfortable for the legislature, the commission, I'm sure, would take your advice and be more specific. But it does create some problems with flexibility down the road.
Mr. Villain, it might be a distinction without a difference. It seems to be an unusual way to budget. I'm looking by contrast on page 10 of the bill. There's an appropriation to the Science Museum, and that's an explicit appropriation to an entity outside of government for a particular purpose. Obviously, that's different from the purposes set forth in those other sections. But usually when I'm just trying to think of other situations, but it strikes me, I mean, obviously we give a lot of grants to nonprofits, and I'm one of the biggest champions of that, and I think at one point received the Legislator of the Year Award from the Nonprofit Association. So I'm a big believer in the utilization of nonprofits. But usually what we've done is if we are giving a public grant to a private organization, i.e. the Science Museum, on page 10, we've specified the grant, or if it's a general operating grant, Senator Anderson, as you have in your bill for the Science Museum, we don't specify the purpose of that. If there happens to be a particular purpose, we do so. If we have a state agency that's making grants to a multiplicity of organizations, then we simply have made the grant or appropriation to the umbrella organization. State Arts Board would be an example of that. We don't have line items within that. So it just strikes me, and again, it might be a distinction without a difference, but it strikes me as something a little bit unique, and maybe there's another example of where we've done it this way, but I can't think of it. Senator Fredrickson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a couple comments about it, too. Several years ago, each of these organizations would come in and make strong proposals to do similar similar things. You know, DU would have a good proposal, Deer Hunters, Nature Conservancy, all wanting to preserve habitat, all wanting to preserve conservation areas. And we encourage them, and they somewhat on their own say, well, why don't we get together rather than each of us come in for a proposal and the commission having to sort through all of those and try and decide which are the most meritorious. They got together with our encouragement and said, well, why don't you do corridors are very important to habitat, very important for vegetative cover. Why don't you get together and form this corridors partnership and worked collaboratively together? So if they find an area, say, in Otter Tail County, where there's an opportunity to purchase or do permanent easements to form a corridor between wetlands or forest and wetlands, something like that, that project might have participation from the Nature Conservancy to conserve native prairie. It might have contributions from Pheasants Forever. It might have Minnesota Deer Hunters Association collaborating on it, and also the Department of Natural Resources. And it, by having this flexibility, they can do that. Yeah. You know, in the next, in one, maybe it's the Deer Hunters Association that have a major part. In the next one, 3-4 months later, it might be the Nature Conservancy. This allows that flexibility and also encourages them to work together, because working together, they can provide more habitat and more corridors than each of them doing it piecemeal.
And Mr. Chair, the LCCMR does have the flexibility under the current practice to make adjustments to the work programs within the constraints of this overall appropriation. Not to say that we would do that without a very, very good reason, and we don't do that very often. So that's, you know, the flexibility that we've had by doing it this way. And obviously, we'd prefer to do it to keep that. Now, if there's a better way to state it so that it doesn't kind of raise issues, we could do that.
Yeah. Well, let me ask a final question. Chairman Parisot.
One point on the whole discussion here. The large partnerships that occur in the partners that are named and others, because each of them has a different something that they can add to projects in common or collectively, and that would be some might be staff, might be in-kind, and some might be specialists in certain areas that have to collaborate, and it might be cash. So they have their, you know, they wouldn't all have the same need for a line item for each organization that way.
Okay. Let me ask a final question relative to this. Again, the habitat corridors, where you've got agreements, organizations specified. Audubon Society shows up and says, we can do this just as well as whatever. Do they get access?
If they're not part of the initial proposal and not part of our recommended allocation, then no, they're not part of this project. They could not be added into a work plan.
But how about 2 years from now?
Next year, in 2007, they can apply. We have a yearly process now.
Okay, so there's nothing static about, you know, in terms of the partnership agreements, this is nothing that couldn't be changed if some other organization showed up and said, we can do this as well.
It could be added on to or potentially changed.
In a new appropriate.
But that would be through the legislative process.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay,
Mr. Chairman, that could occur two ways. They could attempt to join this corridors organization already exists, or they could come in with a separate proposal of their own.
Right, okay. Which would be added
but,
on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so they could go to the corridors organization and say,
we'll bring these resources in. We want in. We have a couple projects we think fit in with your mission.
But, Mr. Chair, if they wanted money, then they would probably be more successful asking for an additional allocation on top of this amount rather than trying to take it away from what's already in here. That would be more difficult.
Okay.
Unless there was some project that for some reason was failing or wasn't able to be completed.
Mr. Villain.
Mr. Chair, the answer to your question about the Nature Conservancy is $430,000. And the reason I know that is because we have a detailed chart of a proposed set of allocations not shown in the language but in the work program document, and that's how we will draft the work programs, that's how we will approve the work programs, and that's how DNR will administer a reimbursement process based on that number and the language and understandings that are in here.
Okay. And those numbers are dealt with within the commission process by the commission members as well.
Right.
Okay, well,
this
has been helpful. Mm-hmm. And Senator Anderson, as you know, I no longer have a statutory position on the LCCMR, but in past years, that's why you had my position, so you could answer all these questions for me.
That's right. And now I have the position myself, so I don't have to answer them anymore.
Once is enough.
Let me think about that one. Okay, thanks. Thanks for the discussion. Further questions, discussion on House File 293? If not, Senator Anderson moves that House File 293 as amended be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion
Thank
carries.
You very much, Mr. Chair and committee
and then lastly, we have Senator Betzold, Senate File 322.
I know more than I did.
Senator Berglund had to leave, so Senator Frederickson moves adoption of the division report.
Well, Mr. Chair, there's actually two division reports. There's one.
I'm sorry.
Senator Foley submitted a Judiciary Budget Division report, and I would move that first. I move the Judiciary Budget Division report.
Okay. All right. So. If Senator Betzold moving the
Judiciary
Division report, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
And then, Mr. Chair, yesterday the Human Services Budget Division heard my bill and then had an A1 amendment. I believe that the original division report is up. I believe Mr. Watson has had that, but it's been prepared now. So you now have this. So I will move the Human Services Budget Diversion Report submitted by Senator Berglund from yesterday's hearing.
All right. We have Senator Betzold moving the division report as submitted by the Human Services Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries.
And Mr. Chair, I'll describe my bill first. Actually, this is a combination of a bill that I had been carrying, and then Senator Berglund had a separate bill that she amended on. And ironically, when her bill was before the Judiciary Committee, I amended my bill onto hers. So, but my bill is one that has apparently made the deadline in the other body, so that's why her bill was added to mine here. Both bills actually are addressing the same issue. They just come from different approaches, and that's the issue of women who abuse alcohol during pregnancy. And as you may know, I've practiced as a defense lawyer in this area for 27 years, and it was brought to my attention actually 2 years ago with a bill that I had that worked its way through the process then to try to find a way to have a very limited scope to try to get some women who are abusing alcohol into some sort of a short-term treatment before, well, any alcohol during pregnancy can lead to fetal alcohol syndrome. The concern that I had was that if you just provided civil commitment from any woman who was using alcohol, that was probably not the type of bill that, from a policy standpoint, could pass. So my bill was crafted rather narrowly, whereas the standard for civil commitment for a chemical dependency person is somebody who excessively and habitually uses alcohol or drugs. This would be limited for pregnancy purposes for somebody who's excessively using alcohol or controlled substances that could lead to damage or physical development of the fetus. Excessive could be in the, you know, could be a relative term because, as I say, any amount of alcohol. But the bill that I had is limited to what's called early intervention. That is, you're lowering the standard, but it would be for a very short period of time where the woman could be required to be in a treatment. That would be 21 days. The bill that Senator Berglund had, which was amended onto this bill, and that was the Budget Division report, does expand existing civil commitment law. And there is a provision in the existing law, which you can see on the division report lines, page 1, lines 20 to 23, that does carve out a provision for a pregnant woman who is habitual or excessive. You can be habitual, drinking every day, but not excessively. Or you could be binging once in a while, and it's not habitual. But as I indicated, any amount could be caused to fetal alcohol syndrome. That is current law, and she just expanded on the use of alcohol or I believe it's is that marijuana or whatever for that now. So that is what she is doing in her bill. I did note you will note that there's a repealer. Again, this is part of Senator Berglund's bill on page 2, and that is repealing a 1998 law that requires mandatory reports of women who are abusing alcohol. But as I say, this is a combination of two bills that really accomplish the same purposes. They just kind of approach it from different angles. There is no fiscal impact to either bill, and that is why we had to review that in the budget divisions just to make sure.
And Senator Betzold, so your legislation allows for...
Mine has early intervention, whereas Senator Berglund's bill is really more for standard civil commitment as a chemically dependent person. Mine is a little bit easier to accomplish, but the outcome is more short term. It's only 21 days, whereas if there is a civil commitment... It could be for a much longer period of time, but it's just it's a matter of proof. It's a matter of what the county attorneys are the ones who prosecute these cases or bring these petitions. They're the ones who have to make the decision which direction they choose to go in. But there's basically two avenues here that they could choose.
Why would we want Senator Berglund's language?
I think the county attorneys. Well, first of all. The current language does not allow for civil commitment of a pregnant woman for habitual or excessive use for any use of alcohol. And I think that has been perceived as a problem that the bill that I
Well, is it, Senator Bissell, I mean, you and I are the people familiar with the commitment process in the legislature. If the county attorney wants, and I've seen it in Ramsey, I don't know about Hennepin, but if the county attorney wants to petition to have somebody who's pregnant committed for whatever reason, they can do so. And I've represented people who've been pregnant who've been committed. I don't know if you have, but I certainly have seen that in the Ramsey probate court.
Well, this issue was brought to me by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and they declined petitions for pregnant women on the grounds that they couldn't prove habitual and excessive use of alcohol. I was concerned that, and of course, in talking to the medical professionals, they wanted a provision in law that said that any use of alcohol would not be permitted. I said, well, we're not going to civilly commit every pregnant woman, you know, who is using any amount of alcohol. That kind of bill's not going to pass. However, I was the author of the early intervention provision, which was aimed towards mentally ill patients, and I figured, well, maybe we've got some play there where we can have somebody who is excessively using it, not habitually, but excessively using alcohol.
No, I understand.
So
I understand
that's where mine came from. Now, Senator Berglund, this is a provision that's been in the law that only applied to opium, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamines. It didn't talk about alcohol. So I think that she felt a need to add alcohol into the list for the pregnant women. And so if we worked independently in developing our bills, and it just happened that we found an opportunity to merge the two bills together. Now, Senator Berglund has stepped out, so I can't have her – she's not here to explain some of her rationale, but I can explain mine. But the bills were married up yesterday, so.
And Senator Bissell, as a practitioner, I understand your bill. As a practitioner, I'm not quite sure about the other part of what's now part of this bill, because it talks about you do the language. So, and I can understand including chemically dependent person, you know, adding that as part of the definition. But then during such pregnancy in a way that is habitual or excessive, or has consumed alcoholic beverages during such pregnancy in any way that is habitual or excessive, it seems to me that either is duplicative or sets a new standard. And then I wonder what happens with other matters, other petitions in the commitment process.
Mr. Chair, again, as you're aware, in order to civilly commit somebody for chemical dependency use, normally you have to show that they are habitually and chemically, the use is habitual and excessive, plus you have to show a danger to self and others, inability to provide for basic needs and so forth. As in my reading of Senator Berglund's bill, you'd still have to show all those things. She's trying to expand it to show that a pregnant woman would have to have habitual or excessive use of, say, alcohol. But I think you still have to show the other tests.
That's duplicative.
Well, but it's not duplicative to what I'm doing, because if the county attorney chooses to go that route, of course, they could get a longer-term commitment. They could get more court involvement, whereas to use early intervention, where you, if that's the route that is chosen, you don't necessarily have to show all those other factors. You just have to show excessive use, but you then get a shorter period of time.
And like I said, I understand the early intervention part of it. Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I missed the very beginning of the discussion, so I hope I'm not asking a dumb question. But habitual, when I was pregnant with one of my children, I believe my rule for myself was to have one glass of wine a month. That sounds habitual. So, what does that mean? And because I thought that was very safe. My doctor agreed that was very safe, and it was a real enjoyable treat for me while I was pregnant to have a glass of wine once a month.
Sure.
That sounds habitual, and I really wouldn't want to be reported to Child Protection for doing that.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, again, in the usual course of civil commitment case of chemical dependency, habitual is not defined in the statute, and I don't know if I don't believe it's defined in case law, but there's clearly cases where people are drinking regularly, almost every day, and they're drinking excessively. And it's a fact problem. It has to be proven in civil commitment law by clear and convincing evidence.
Well, Mr. Chair.
But with pregnancy, there is testimony that any amount of alcohol could be damaging the fetus. Now, I don't think once a month anybody's going to call that habitual, and I don't think one glass is going to be called excessive. But
Mr. Chair, I'm talking about the reports. It's certainly not enough for commitment, but if it's enough for a report, that would concern me. Because it's not defined.
The
required reporting.
Well, Mr. Chair, the required reporting on is being repealed on page 2, line 14.
That's what 14. I'm trying to track here on page.
That's of the division report. I'm sorry. They're signed by Senator Berglund. It was heard yesterday.
But
and there's currently a 1998 law mandating reports of alcohol abuse by pregnant women, and Senator Berglund is proposing to have that repealed in her bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, I'm reading the division report. Page 1, Section 3, reports required. That part's not being repealed. So I don't know what the difference between this section and the section that's being repealed. One is 5563, one is 5561. So the part that's still in the bill, that's being amended, says a person mandated report must report a pregnant woman who has consume alcohol in a way that's habitual or excessive. And I think that's excessive.
Well, again, this is Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson. This was Senator Berglund's bill that was amended onto my bill, so.
Okay, and she's not here, unfortunately, and I'm not on the committee, so I can ask more questions about it, but I'm uncomfortable with the language. And, Mr. Chair, can I ask one other question? And again, I apologize that you may have talked about this. What is tetrahydrocannabinol?
Oh, it was testified yesterday. Senator Berglund referred to it. I don't know if that's marijuana or not. I don't remember.
It seems to have some connection, Mr. Chair, to marijuana, but it's not a word I've seen before.
Mr. Jarofsky apparently has some
expertise. Do you have any experience?
Tetrahydrocannabinol is the active ingredient in marijuana THC.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I wouldn't have known that.
And is there any...
Boy, that's a smart staff, huh? Yeah.
they do a lot of reading.
Yeah.
or whatever.
I guess I'm curious to know if there's evidence that medical evidence that that's harmful to pregnancy. I guess I have not that I have any personal experience with that.
Me neither.
Habitual or otherwise.
Anybody else want to make a denial on the record?
Let's just stop with this conversation. But I don't. I'm not aware. I've never heard that. I've never heard discussion about that. Honestly.
Senator Frederickson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, on the Health Human Service Division report, the section we're talking about, I would move on lines 30 and 34, delete such and insert the.
Okay. Which page? Three.
So, I'm sorry.
Chairman, on lines 30 and 34, delete such and insert the.
Oh, okay. Okay, Senator Ferguson's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. I guess, Senator Betzold, I'm not sure what, you know, I have a couple of questions. Senator Anderson has a couple of questions.
None of them about my bill. But
I understand that.
Okay.
So that's what, Angie, did we... we find Senator Berglund?
She's on her way down.
Oh, okay. I was possibly going to suggest, and Senator Betzel, I don't know about the timeline for this, for your bill. I was going to suggest the possibility of laying over. Angie indicates that... Senator Berglund is on her way down.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, when she's finished with her meeting, I have to go to my meeting with Senator Pogemiller. So that might not be very helpful from my point of view, but I appreciate the thought.
And I didn't bring any witnesses in, and both Senator Berglund and I are on this committee, and here's Senator Berglund, so we can...
I think I'm due upstairs.
Do you have a minute, or do you want to...
Well, sure. I can take one more minute.
Senator Berglund, the question we have is in regard to your amendment to Senator Betzold's bill. And there are a couple lines of question. Senator Betzold and I are the people who have experience in the building with the practice of commitment law. And so we're trying to determine whether or not your language sets a different standard. Is it duplicative of what can be done within the probate court as it is? Senator Anderson's question is a little bit different, and that is the definition of habitual or excessive and how that relates. What's the fine line between what's habitual or excessive as opposed to a more normal usage for this purpose?
And Mr. Chair, if I can just provide Senator Berglund with what the response that I gave is the fact that with the bill that I've got dealing with early intervention, it's a more narrow standard because you're not having to prove danger to self or others, inability to provide for basic needs, but you're only going to get a 21-day treatment standard out of it. Senator Berglund's bill is amending the current commitment law, which would allow for a longer period of time, but it is amending the current part of the law on pregnant women. You don't have to show habitual and excessive use. You show habitual or excessive use, and it adds alcohol and apparently the active ingredient of marijuana.
And because Senator Anderson has to go, maybe we could try to answer her question first.
Okay.
And her question was?
The report. I made a confession that during one of my pregnancies, I think I
drank
a glass of wine a month. That was my my limit. And so that sounds habitual to me.
Oh.
And so it concerns me that any amount could be considered habitual, and that seems a little extreme. And Senator Betzold
no,
said
this is,
there's no definition of habitual.
Right, but this is amending the mandated reporting law. So, you know, if your physician wasn't, telling you or giving you any indication of concern about it, there'd be no ramifications for it.
Well,
the reason that we have habitual or excessive in the law is because there's binge drinking, or there's drinking continually, and either one of those things can cause a child to be born with fetal alcohol syndrome. And we don't pretend this law is going to catch everybody that should even be caught, but the threat of commitment has caused many women who are addicted to drugs to go into treatment when they're pregnant.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I support what you're doing in your bill, and I'm very aware of the harm and the danger that you're trying to prevent. I just don't want a law that's so broad that it raises concerns of privacy and it's just undue interference in people's lives that isn't warranted. You know, I wouldn't have wanted to be reported by some nurse who thought I was, if I talked about this with my doctor and said, is it okay if I have a glass of wine at Christmas, you know, when I'm pregnant, to have someone call up and report me. I mean, that just seems excessive. And I support what you're trying to do, and I just think that's, you know, that's the point of defining things carefully in laws so that you don't have that danger of it being abused, the law being abused.
Well, we haven't found abuse of the law
well
under the current use for people using controlled substances, and many times they're also drinking.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, you know, we hear that a lot about criminal laws, that they haven't been abused. But the point is that we should write them so that they can't be abused. That's the point I'm trying to make, that they should be carefully written and drafted so that they go, and that's what the meaning of due process is under the Constitution, you know, that they have to be narrowly tailored to achieve the purpose that they're trying to intend rather than be subject to interpretation to be used for a harmful purpose, which could happen. I just don't want that potential to be there. I'm not concerned about myself. I'm just suggesting as an example that the potential is there, and I think it just needs to be more carefully defined. I've got to go.
And then, Senator Berglund, just on the question of the court process, in terms of commitment, does this lower the standard? Does it duplicate what's there? That was my question.
It would be the same standard that's used today for women who are pregnant who are abusing drugs. There would be reporting under this law that's required of medical professionals. Then the county would intercede and do an assessment, chemical dependency assessment. So, you know, if Senator Anderson had gotten caught in an over-aggressive nurse or something reporting her, an assessment would be done to see if a person is simply, you know, drinking while pregnant or whether they are chemically dependent. And if they're chemically dependent, then they could be referred to the court for commitment if they don't voluntarily enter treatment.
Sarah Betzel?
Well, that's true. And again, the section of the statute that's being amended here has been in law for a while, dealing with chemically dependent women who have habitually or excessive use. But I believe that this is a higher standard. It's just adding two more, one drug plus alcohol to the standard. But the petition would still have to allege all the other factors in order to get a commitment. But if you get a commitment here, you know, it could be up to 6 months, whereas the early intervention that I have is a lower standard and narrower, but you're only going to get 21 days out of that.
My inclination is probably to defer to the Hennepin County members. I'm not sure this will make a lot of difference in Ramsey, and I'm not sure in Hennepin, you know, in Ramsey, Ramsey has a contract with Washington County where the Ramsey Probate Court handles all the Washington County matters. I don't know if Hennepin has any similar contract with smaller counties or not
for
the probate court petitions.
In Hennepin County, I mean, they're unique, of course, in many respects across the state, but the county, they have a number of county attorneys that handle this. There's a private defense bar that handles these matters.
My comment was that I assume between Hennepin and Ramsey County,
right. You're dealing with
90% of the petitions.
Correct.
You know, 80. So I'm inclined to think that, Senator Berglund, that your language is probably duplicative of practice in Ramsey County, and that's why I'm saying that I'd be inclined to defer to, if this is a particular Hennepin County need, to defer to that.
Well,
Senator Berglund?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could just also explain when this original law was passed for pregnant women. The reason that alcohol was not included was because there was this huge fear that it would have a real chilling effect on women seeking medical care while they're pregnant. And what we've seen over the last 10 years with the law in place for people, women using drugs, it hasn't happened. There hasn't been no chilling effect on women seeking medical care during their pregnancy. And what we have seen with the law for women who are chemically dependent using controlled substances is that it has had a very positive impact on getting women into treatment. And it happens most of the time without ever going through court and getting a commitment, just having the threat of being able to do so.
Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzel, Senator Berglund, to Senator Anderson's point about a glass of wine, if on line 31, where it says, in any way that is habitual or excessive, would it solve that problem if we'd say in any way that is habitual and excessive are excessive in single occurrences?
Mr. Chair and Senator Fredrickson, again, when we're dealing with the pregnant women, it's so much different from the rest of the commitment law, which, habitual and excessive, although it isn't defined, it's one of those things that it's so clear when these cases come to court that somebody is habitually, you know, using it all the time and excessively. They're binging, they're overusing it way beyond what's normal. I don't know what the standard should be for a pregnant woman, although in the Judiciary Committee we did have doctors who practice that, and they, you know, their testimony was any amount in pregnancy can be damaging the fetus. They don't know because until the child's born, they don't know if they're dealing with fetal alcohol syndrome. I don't know. I think that the practitioners in this area would prefer that it be habitual or excessive because either one of them could be damaging. Now, could Senator Anderson have developed fetal alcohol syndrome by one glass of wine a month? I guess there are some people that would suggest that could happen, but I don't think that any stretch of the imagination anybody could argue that one glass of wine a month is habitual, and it's certainly not excessive. But I think either one of those could lead to fetal alcohol syndrome.
Mr. Chairman, I might also just add that most of the cases where people have talked about using this law, if it were passed, are cases where women have already had a child born with fetal alcohol syndrome and are pregnant again and are continuing to abuse alcohol. So it's pretty clear what's going to happen if you don't intervene.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I entirely understand that. I also understand what Senator Anderson was saying.
Well, I go with Senator Betzold on this. I think this is a term of art that is understood by the legal community, and I think if we start creating new words here, that it's just going to create more problems, not solve anything.
Well, this has been helpful.
Thank you.
Any thoughts?
I believe we did adopt the division report, did we?
Yes,
not?
We did.
I want to make sure. Well, if there's no further questions and nobody here to testify on it, Mr. Chair, then I'll move that Senate File 322 as amended be recommended to pass.
Okay, we have Senator Betzold's motion in front of us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Betzold, and meeting's adjourned. Say, Linda.